Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. If you spotted Bizarre Foods Andrew Zimmerman stirring up a big pot of shrimp etouffee with me at the Mid-City Farmers Market recently, this is the show you've been waiting for. But if you missed that fun afternoon, we're about to give you a vicarious glimpse into the whirlwind experience of a live taping with the inimitable Andrew Zimmerman. Stay tuned for all that excitement and our culinary quiz question on this week's Louisiana Eats. Andrew Zimmerman recently crossed the state of Louisiana filming his new MSN web series, Appetite for Life. You never know what you're going to get when a celebrity comes to town, but I found Andrew to be one of the most creative, perceptive, and highly intelligent TV talent I'd ever worked with. Buckle your seatbelts. My afternoon with Andrew was a wild ride. You conquered the TV audience with Bizarre Foods, mm-hmm. So why a web show now?
Well, we've been doing it now for 3 years. It's one of several web series that I do. It's the most successful one. The web is extremely interesting to me. I think its democratic nature allows for an incredible amount of participation by anybody who has a website. Takes off about $25 and about 3 hours on a computer. In fact, someone pointed out to me the other day that actually there are a lot of places where for $10 and a few clicks of your mouse, you actually get a website set up for you. You can download your content right to it. So I like participating in something that I think is the most egalitarian form of content-driven engagement across multiple platforms in the history of the world. I want to be a part of that. I also think it's a bottom-up system rather than a top-down system. And I think most importantly, I thought that it was a way to reach a whole different audience. And our web series cumulatively is outpunches our TV series by factors of dozens to one. I mean, it's an incredible, incredibly popular show.
That's fabulous. So tell me, what was the genesis of Appetite for Life?
I sat down with some folks who wanted to creatively put content onto their website, the folks at MSN. They had been working with a bunch of different sponsors to try to develop some ideas. Toyota was the one that was into collaborating in the best way possible. We have some great production partners, some California companies, iBoogie and Reveille. And the four of us co-produced this amazing project. What's great about it is that, to me, it's like the restaurant business. You get out there, you shoot for a day. I mean, we just finished shooting with you. You saw, I mean, it's like, other than someone screaming, pause, turn around, you know, turn to the other side and cheating you, we don't gin anything up. We don't recreate anything. We don't stop for anything. And, you know, the next day you just move on and it's a whole new day. So yeah. I like, from a personal standpoint, as someone who likes creating stuff, it's perfect for the artist inside me, because I don't have to worry too much about it. What's done is done.
That was the absolute quickest shoot I've ever seen. Just boom.
Yeah. We're also, I should say, I think you can do that in this business when you have super talented people around you. I don't think I'm anything special, but our sound people, our technical team, our production team, and our videographers are the best in the business.
Why did you choose to spotlight the Crescent City Farmers Market Match program on the New Orleans episode of Appetite for Life?
You know, every year we pick a different theme, and this year, as you so wonderfully stated, it is a road trip for good. I happen to believe that with the amount of attention my public life gets, and as it grows, that's an incredible platform. But that's given to me by my audience. That's not anything that I earned. That's a gift. And I think with that comes a tremendous responsibility. I think that people who are in my position who don't give back by highlighting ways in which we can persuade people to get involved in also giving back and stretching sideways instead of pulling things in towards them is is necessary. It's my responsibility. It also makes me feel really good. I don't want to stand in a kitchen and tell people how they should eat or what they should eat. I don't want to run around town saying, go here, go there, unless there's a point to it or unless there's a story. And the story here of this market is fantastic. I live and breathe the food world, as do you. And I think what gets you excited is not just that you get to come here and engage with an audience and talk about the things you love. It's that you get to do it in a setting that fits your values. And it makes a difference in your community.
This season's bizarre food is totally U.S.-based.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you find the most bizarre foods in the U.S.?
Oh, my gosh. Cumulatively, pound for pound, it's still New York City. And that's because it's the biggest. I mean, you have so much bandwidth for insanity there. That's number one. Number two, no matter how small your audience, if you want to create a restaurant for people who only like green food, that's only open on Tuesdays, that's an unsustainable economic model for any restaurateur in any city in the world except New York, where there's probably enough people obsessed with green food who only want to eat it on Tuesdays. You know what I'm saying?
I absolutely
Plus, you have people, you know, there's, you know, 109 languages spoken in the school system there. I mean, that's just giving an idea of the number of neighborhoods there that make you feel like you're back in the old country, so to speak.
Was Louisiana a close second?
Louisiana is not even in the top five. And part of that is my own personal bias. I think Louisianans think that they might have a corner on that, but that's only because of the hunting and fishing geeks and the fact that you eat a lot of pork products and cow products that a lot of other states don't. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, about half the country, everywhere from West Virginia to New Mexico, from Louisiana to Montana, still eats snout to tail. They're not part of the modern gastropub movement. They've always been eating that way. You know, you don't need a bunch of fancy pants chefs charging $30 a plate for hog ponts to know that it's good. Most people just know it's good here. That being said, my personal bias and why I don't include it is that I think Louisiana is the greatest food culture in our country. I don't think there's another state in the union when you say its name, you actually can taste it. When I say Colorado, it's mountains. When I say Rhode Island, it's something very small and, you know, beautiful city of Providence. But nobody says the word Louisiana or the city name New Orleans without instantaneously thinking of food.
So, Andrew, how do you decide what's bizarre and what's not?
I don't. I'm more concerned with redefining the word than putting labels on anything. You know, I believe in telling stories from the fringe, and that's what excites me. And I think it captures the imagination of the viewers more. I got an easy job. I mean, you know, if I was trying to tell stories about, you know, frozen skinless chicken breasts in a market, I'd have a tough time. You got to work to tell a story there. There is a story there. It's not a very good one. I think when it comes to bizarre, what I want to do is tell stories about culture through food. The best of those stories are the ones from the fringe. I hope that I'm somewhat entertaining and appealing to people and that they care about what I think and how I feel and why I like to travel. And along the way, some people think some of the stuff I eat is weird, but not the people I'm eating it with. Bubba didn't think hog ponts is strange. You don't think hog ponts is strange. But when I'm in tribal Africa and I try to offer them a piece of cheese and they say, why do you Americans obsess about letting perfectly good milk rot, dry it into little squares and eat it? You realize that this is simply a perception and a psychological issue, which is why there's no picky children, just sort of lazy parents.
Well, in all your travels and your exposure to the bizarre foods, you're also absorbing and observing all these different cultures and mm-hmm. customs and rituals.
Sure.
Could you maybe give us an example of some of your more interesting experiences?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Kalahari, a year and a half ago with the Juntwazi. These are the people who are profiled in the movie The Gods Must Be Crazy. In fact, the family group we were with was the group that made that movie. We were only the second team of outsiders to ever really have contact with them for longer than a drive-by. I lived with them for a week. Previous to joining up with them, I was traveling through Botswana to get to them. It took us days to get to the Juntwazi. They live in the Aha Hills just outside of Maun, a very remote part of the Okavango Delta, one of the most beautiful places in the world. They live nomadically, according to the season, rain or not rain. They'll move, live in very simple grass huts the size of this outdoor metal picnic table we're sitting at. They use it only for sleeping. They don't have their own possessions. Everything is community owned. They're the most beautiful, simple people in the world. And I observed cave paintings with shamanistic rituals and dances that were 30,000 years old. And then I got to see those exact same dances and experiences with them. Anthropologists, much smarter people than me, believe there's only three men in the world that really can project their souls into other places, one of which was the head shaman in the camp that we were in. An incredible people that, just to give you an idea of their skill set, we were never allowed to leave camp without 6 quarts of water on our person. It's extremely dry and hot there. We would travel all day. We'd leave. We'd come back. We'd have no water on any of us. You're constantly, constantly drinking water and taking medicine to help your body process it better. We never saw them drink during the day. They would just eat these little berries along the way to help them not think about water. And physiologically, they had altered themselves to fit their environment. They have poison arrows that can drop an elephant if they choose to shoot one. In about 3 minutes, it'll die from just one small little arrow. The poison is so strong. But yet when they hunt antelope, they think it's fun to run them down. Three of them will use a coordinated stalking and then start running after them. And as the animal sort of veers one way, there's another one of the tribe members coming at it and kicks it back towards the rest of them. And they basically herd it over the course of 8-9 hours running in the desert, right, into an area where the animal just gets so exhausted that they can walk up to it and quickly dispatch it, usually with a small knife or by strangulation. Now, I say this not to be gross, but simply because this is what they think is fun to do in the Kalahari Desert. I mean, these guys, are unbelievable. They see a bird in the sky called the honey bird, and they run sometimes as much as a day and a half to follow the bird in the sky because they know it means ultimately it's going to go for bee larvae where there is honey. And there are very little, few flowers in the desert, so you know how rare that is. They are the most mystical people I've ever experienced. They can track animals and tell you within minutes size, species, where it was moving, how big it was. I've never been as impressed as I have with a people I've ever met in my life.
What's their population size like?
The family group I was with was about 22, 23, and there are several pockets of them. They're one of the disappearing tribes, you know, like the Pilchi Indians, like the Himba, like many other famous tribes around the world that are. The landscape is changing so quickly, I'm not sure that their traditional ways of living are sustainable.
In your estimation, after all these years of traveling mm-hmm. and eating, what to you is the most bizarre thing you ever ate?
Oh, gosh. It's usually things that I never knew existed before. There's a lot of things that are, you know, some people think are gross, you know, eating a wild fruit bat or something like that. But at least I knew bats existed and people ate them before I came in contact with them. I was in the middle of the Pacific Ocean off the islands of Samoa and 6,000 feet of water, tuna fishing. The captain stopped the boat and dropped nets that were like coffee filters and scooped this scum off the top of the ocean surface. It's called Palolo. It's a worm that helps the coral reefs regenerate. It floats up out of the coral bed, kills itself in the sun. It's a suicide mission. And then it drops back down onto the coral floor and it helps regenerate this. But for a brief moment while it's up there, it can be scooped, sauteed, and it's like mush, green algae mush. And it tasted like a cross between foie gras and seawater. I mean, it was,
wow.
I know, it was crazy.
Well, thank
if I hadn't done it myself, I would doubt its existence.
Thank goodness you're getting pictures of this for us all to see.
Sometimes.
So our Louisiana Eats listeners had yep. some questions for you.
Sure.
One was, anything you've ever eaten that you ever regretted later?
Oh, gosh. The last two times I got food poisoning was eating mussels in restaurants. I love mussels. I eat them everywhere. And occasionally, if you love mussels like I do, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners do, you know that there's, you know, 100 of them in a bowl and it's all about the broth and just slobbering the thing up and a bad one goes down. It's like, oops, too late. And, you know, sometimes it means an uncomfortable evening. So that sort of regret has...
Any stomach meds you travel with?
I don't take anything prophylactically. I do travel with Cipro in case something happens to me. So after the fact, I won't be as sick. I carry Pepto-Bismol for indigestion. It's natural. It's bismuth. You know, I give my kid uses it. My wife uses it. There's always a bottle in our fridge. I grab one when I head out on the road. But, you know, I don't take anything. I carry Imodium, you know, of course. I mean, every traveler should, but I rarely use it.
Well, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to sit down.
The diarrhea thing was the last question. We're leaving on a down note. I'm just kidding.
That was Bizarre Foods, Andrew Zimmerman,
sharing his appetite for life. It's time for our Louisiana Eats Culinary Quiz Question of the Week, brought to you with support from French Market Coffee. The correct answer to last week's question, what is the name of the waterfowl deemed proper for Lenten consumption by fasting French Creoles of the 18th and 19th centuries, is the poule du. Because this particular duck lived on the water, ate exclusively from the water, and actually had a fishy taste, Creoles considered it within the bounds of Lenten fasting. Now let's see who this week's lucky winner is. Thomas Walsh, our Louisiana Eats producer, is manning the grinder.
Well, Lord knows there's plenty of knowledgeable Catholics and hunters in Louisiana, but the sparse number of 18th century Creoles really made this quiz challenging. No need to worry, Tim Garrett of New Orleans knows his poule du and is taking home our prize. Drop us a line for your chance to win.
Our lucky winner will be receiving 3 full-size bags of French Market coffee, including dark roast with chicory, and French roast. This week's question is, what starchy tuber was responsible for the Great Irish Famine of 1845? Send your answers to Louisiana Eats at wwno.org by midnight Sunday night. All correct answers received will be mixed together in our French Market coffee grinder, and one lucky winner will be chosen at random and announced on next week's show. Again, this week's question is, what starchy tuber was responsible for the Great Irish Famine of 1845? Email those answers by midnight Sunday night to Louisiana Eats at wwno.org with culinary quiz in the subject line, and you could be next week's lucky winner. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. When Andrew Zimmerman wanted to tape a cooking segment with me at the Crescent City Farmers Market, we decided shrimp etouffee was the perfect choice.
Butter is what you use to make the etouffee.
Of course, gotcha.
So you have some butter for us, I think.
It's the backbone.
It absolutely
backbone,
is.
Huh? It is the backbone.
And a large reason for the size of my back end.
You know...
I'm a butter girl.
Here's the thing, in a world that has become very health conscious, I think people have lost sight of the fact that butter is still not 100% fat.
That's
and
right.
All the oils the are. Am I right?
Exactly.
Am I right?
Yeah.
I tell people that all the time. I'm like, that fancy oil you're using is 100% fat.
How about this?
This right here, not.
Well, you know what? Let's throw this in the pot and keep shopping. I'm going to take the bag.
You need it? This is my sauce.
I got it. Come on.
You're
good.
You got a lot of butter?
Now, how about this? You see these shrimp?
Yeah.
$6 a pound. You buy 3 pounds or more, the price goes down to $5.
Do you want to know what's more impressive than the price?
What?
To have fresh, head-on, local shrimp that when you smell them, still has that iodine, seawater, minerally intensity that just has nothing to do with shrimp that's been out of the water even a couple more hours than this. Just glorious.
When did Pete catch these shrimp?
Yesterday.
Yesterday, you see.
Unbelievable. So these are the ones we're cooking with, for sure.
Absolutely. So would you weigh out a couple pounds of those for us, Claire?
These are the ones that I'm going to throw into my Venza for snacking later on. Those are the ones we're going to cook with now. And by the way, I should point out, there's only a handful of communities around the United States, back me up on this, where you actually can buy a shrimp with the best tasting part of it attached to the body. Why the rest of America eats this part of the shrimp and throws away that part, I have no idea. There is something wrong with you. Whole, fresh, wild caught shrimp. All right, yeah, let's do that.
All right, thank you, Claire.
We'll throw that one in there.
Woo!
Thank you. That was seriously so good.
You ready for some etouffee?
I sure am. Let's
All
go.
All right, let's go.
Andrew, we love your show.
Oh,
we're
thank
so
you. I appreciate
here.
That. Thank you.
I brought along some tomato paste, and we started by whisking it together in the melted butter. Then we added sliced green onions, some minced garlic, and a little thyme and bay. Whisking in a bit of shrimp stock, that etouffee sauce came together. The raw peeled shrimp were stirred in last with salt and hot sauce for a real taste of Louisiana. In less than 5 minutes, the etouffee was ready to serve over the steaming hot rice. My new friend Andrew Zimmerman proclaimed this the easiest and most delicious etouffee he had ever seen. For a copy of this recipe and a link to the Louisiana Eats episode of Andrew's MSN show, Appetite for Life, visit our Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and this is Louisiana Eats. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us on Friday, March the 23rd, for a live taping of Louisiana Eats. Our special guests are Lynn Rosetta Casper of The Splendid Table and Road Foods Jane and Michael Stern. Visit wwno.org for more information. Next week, just in time for St. Patrick's Day, we visit with New Orleans' favorite Irishman, Chef Matt Murphy.
St. Patrick's Day this year will probably be up early in the kitchen, like every holiday occasion, and I'll probably be right in the thick of it, making sure that everybody that's either going to St. Patrick's Cathedral and on their way to the parade gets fed in a timely and fast manner.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan's Steakhouse, Palace Cafe and the Bourbon House, Lights Egan Funeral Homes, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Cookin' Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to Thomas Walsh, our associate producer and sound engineer. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.